I'd like now to welcome to the program Rob Lemkin. He is an award-winning filmmaker. His new documentary is called Enemies of the People, and it opens at the Screen here in Santa Fe this coming Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Now, this is a documentary that you made in partnership with Cambodian journalist Thet Sambat, who lost his family during the Khmer Rouge genocide in the 1970s. Sambat set out to understand why the genocide happened, and he did so in a way that took years and years of relationship building with the very people who both ordered and did the killing. How and when in this process did you get involved?
I got involved in 2006, after about 7 years into Sambat's project, and originally I'd gone to make my own film about the Khmer Rouge, who were coming towards a trial situation. They were kind of, there was a bit rumors that they were going to be arrested at some point in the kind of imminent future and that they would go to trial. And so I was interested in doing that film, and I met Sambat, who was initially working as my fixer and translator. But then I realized that actually he was already much further down the road than I could ever be. But he hadn't really at that point planned to make a documentary, certainly not one like The Enemies of the People that we did make. And so we decided to join forces, and we pulled our separate skills and our separate experiences and our separate ideas, and we joined forces and made the film together for the next 3 years. So from the 10-year project, I was involved for the last 3 years. The first seven, he was on his own.
He makes it clear that he's not doing this for the sake of journalism, but rather for history. But it looks, when you watch the film, as if he's also trying to deal with just the impossible grief of losing his family. He lost his parents, his siblings. His father was very brutally killed by stabbing. It was a slow death. And in the process, he's gaining the trust of the people who committed the most horrible mass killings. He's getting to know their families. He's apparently being open to their humanity, and all the while he's hiding his family's history. Tell us about this dynamic. What did that look like to you?
Well, I thought it was something that was really interesting, because I think on the one hand, Sambat, his kind of conscious self, had said to himself, well, I'm going to do this work. I'm going to find out, you know, I'm going to get these people to confess to me what happened. I'm going to get to some understanding about why all of this happened, why my parents died, not just obviously his parents, there were 2 million people in general, but why all of this violence happened in this time. I'm going to get to understand it, and I'm going to put aside my emotions. I'm going to put aside myself as a kind of suffering little child who had his childhood world destroyed by this terrible regime and this terrible time. And that was something that he consciously did. But at the same time, I think what he was really doing was something as well, was something very much trying to almost really sort of somehow find a way of dealing with his past family, his dead family that had been killed in this way, and kind of properly being able to say goodbye to them by coming to understand what it was that had happened. I think when he was 8, 7, 8, 9 years old, when these terrible events happened, he was a little kid. He didn't really have, I mean, no one understands, even if they're adults, really, what's going on, but certainly little children had no idea what was going on. And he spent the next 30 years just really wondering, well, what was all that did happen? And I think that in trying to do this work, he was also trying to find a way back to be in contact with the family that, you know, had been taken from him. Of course, as we see in the film, there's a kind of trade-off in there, because, of course, his wife and his two lovely young children now are, although he spends a lot of time with them, of course, because he works in the city and he sees them every night, he is spending most of his weekends going off in pursuit of this difficult quest, and so he is, in a way, spending more time with his dead family in some respects than with his living family that are there and waiting for him to come back from his travels.
And as the film shows, his family makes some real sacrifices for him to be able to do this work. There's one amazing, very brief scene where he says, yeah, I didn't leave enough money for food for my family today. Oh, well, I still got to go out and do this. It's quite something. But why did these people agree to talk to him?
Well, I think the reason why they talked to him is because, firstly, they wanted to talk. I mean, they all knew that they were involved with something really, really deep and terrible. And I think when it comes down to the sort of the killers who perpetrated these killings out in the countryside, they have kept this sort of buried in their breasts for the last sort of 30 years. They've not told a single soul really about what they've done. They've not told their own wives. In the case of the woman, there's one woman in this film that who was also a sort of middle-ranking Khmer Rouge perpetrator. She's not told her husband. You know, all of these people have not told their families and their spouses about what they've done. And they do really want to talk about it. But, of course, they don't want to talk about it. And for it to turn into a huge accusation and massive kind of recrimination and judgment of them, they kind of want to find a way of being able to edge into a sort of truth-telling process in which they can at least feel that they're doing some good rather than kind of losing control over everything that they've done. And I think that's what Sambat enabled them to do by going so patiently, so slowly, so considerately, so humanely. He allows them to feel comfortable with edging slowly and gradually into telling the truth that they've wanted to do. And they, you know, all of them, and there are a few people in this film, but there are many people that Sambat and I filmed, and there are even many more people that he worked with before he met me. All of these people feel an awful lot better for talking about it, and I think it does point to a kind of possible path to a more peaceful reconciliation process in Cambodian society than has been thought possible till now.
I was thinking about this in relation to the truth and reconciliation process, and in a way, it's like that, only even perhaps, I mean, until this film, much more private, much less public than a truth and reconciliation process would be, and done in a way that is so, as you say, so gentle and humane that it staggers perhaps the imagination, perhaps the Western imagination, that somebody would have the humanity to do it in the way that Sambat did.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fundamental thing, is that he is coming to all of these people in a spirit of no spirit of judgment or accusation. He simply comes and says, please tell me what you did. And he has immense respect and appreciation of how dangerous and how difficult it is for these people to tell the truth of what they did. It is actually really still physically very dangerous for these people to talk in this way. Many people actually, for example, in the Cambodian American audience in America, really appreciate how big a step it is that these people have taken. And when they realize that there is an appreciation by him of what they're doing, that kind of emboldens them and helps them to sort of keep talking. And of course, this film was made over many years in which they talked in, you know, ever more greater detail about what it was that they were involved with.
We're talking to Rob Lemkin about his new documentary, Enemies of the People. There was an anti-communist rationale for the killings, an ethnic component of that the killers talk about. But ultimately, what do we learn about the reason for the killings of these millions of people?
I think, in a way, what we see in this film, Sambat says at the beginning, you know, he wants to know why so many people died, and by the end, he says he feels he knows. I think what we see in this film largely is actually the how of what happened. We see how so many people could be killed because we could see that there is a kind of an apparatus, there's a hierarchy, there's a chain of command in which when brother number two, who's the most senior person to the top leader, Pol Pot, is having a meeting with Pol Pot, and they decide in a kind of rather abstract political meeting that they're going to kill certain types of people, that this ripples down, and the reality out in the rice fields and the paddies of Cambodia is something, you know, that we also see because we talk to the people who did it, is something very, very sort of bloodthirsty and quite massive. So we can see the how. We also see a little bit in this particular film of the perception. We put ourselves in the mind of the leadership of the Khmer Rouge. So we put ourselves into the mind of number two, brother number two, because he tells us what he was thinking at the time. And we begin to understand that. What we don't really understand is, I think in this film, is the real political origins of why this huge force of violence was unleashed. And that is something that we were we have filmed, and we're putting it into a second film because we were simply unable to get it into this first film. It was just too much of a extra material. This film is the film that is opening with you this week is a very personal film, and a film about, in a way, the universal sort of spirit and the universal horror of this kind of violence. The actual, perhaps more specific causes and explanation for why this violence really happened, and I think it is explicable, but it will come out in a subsequent film. As I say, it's material that we've already filmed. It's just that we couldn't quite get it all done in one 90-minute film.
One of the interviewees was Pol Pot's right-hand man, and Samba talked to him for years before he began to open up and say things about the killings. What did you feel was his sense and his role in the whole thing? Or is that more material that you're going to talk about in the second film? We should wait for that.
No, I could talk a little bit about that. I mean, he's the brother number two. His name is Nun Chir. He was actually one of the two main leaders of the Khmer Rouge. So Pol Pot became the number one person in the early 1960s, but it could have been this man, Nun Chir. In fact, it was a decision by Nun Chir, who had, in the early 60s, was number two in the kind of hierarchy, and Pol Pot was number three, and there was another guy who was number one. That number one guy went off the scene, and then instead of this guy, number two, brother number two, becoming number one, he decided to appoint Pol Pot to the number one position. So, and then the agreement was made between them that basically they would define, they would make all of the big decisions of the party together. You've got to remember, this is a very secret, small party that was kind of organizing in an illegal way in the 1960s and then going off into the forest and hiding in the jungles. And, you know, to be honest, if it hadn't been for the immense sort of barrage of bombing of Cambodia by largely American air forces, actually it was a secret bombing ordered by Kissinger and Nixon, it's quite possible that the Khmer Rouge may not have come to power. But that was such a huge kind of inferno that people were driven into the arms of this very kind of extreme political party, which had started very small but became sort of, as it were, catapulted into a much bigger force by the mid-70s. But still, at that point, when they came to power, Pol Pot and Nun Chir, the one in our film, Brother Number Two, had this arrangement that they were the two people that ran the party and that all the big decisions of the party and therefore of the state, when they became in charge of the state, were going to be made by them. And their problem really was that they saw that they were struggling to stay in control of their party, that there was other people who were in the party who wanted to take it down a different line. And their solution, as they called it, in a rather macabre term, was to kill the people who were, as they saw, enemies of the revolution, or enemies of the people, as they called them, because the revolution was for the people. So they killed those people that were their rivals for power. And that rippled down, because they weren't just dealing with people at the very highest level, that was rippling down into villages and commune level out in the countryside, where the entire of the society was still organized by this communist party, but all of the different aspects of the party were fragile and unstable, and so the killing kind of got kind of rippled out across the country in that way.
And they were killing children. Small children, teenagers, people who in no way could be thought to be ideological traitors or something like that. I mean, it's one of the many examples how genocide just takes on a life of its own and has nothing to do. I mean, even if you could justify it, which it's hard to do, but even if you could justify it, it has nothing to do with its original purpose.
Yeah, and in fact, we held a very interesting conference. It was a video conference between survivors of the killing fields who now live in Long Beach in California and the killers and the perpetrators who were in our film. And they talked over the video conference to each other for 3 hours. And the very first question that was asked by one of the victims or one of the survivors of the killing fields was exactly that question. We understand that you may have wanted to kill sort of enemies and sort of people who were kind of, you know, operating against you, but why did you kill children? And the answer came back from one of the killers and one of the people who one of the main characters in our film. He said, well, we had to, because we were told that we had to rip out the enemy by the root. And there was this feeling, for some reason, there was this kind of really bizarre feeling that if they killed somebody, that that person's family would then have a kind of feeling of anger and a kind of need for revenge against them. So to guard against revenge in the future, they would end up basically taking out the whole family. And this is why, again, it's not a rationale. And I think what's interesting is that the people in our film don't feel good about that. They can almost hardly believe that they did it, but they did do it, and they did it 30 years ago, and they did it time and time and time and time again.
I was looking at the Wikipedia entry under genocides, and according to this list, there have been 25 genocides in the second half of the 20th century. And one lesson I took from the film is that ideology is really not the reason. You can have this ideology or that ideology. You can have ultra-right-wing, ultra-left-wing. You can have the post-Holocaust slogan, never again, but it happens again, you know, year after year, generation after generation. And really the big question to me that emerged, or the big questions, which maybe are unanswerable, is how do you see it coming, and what do you do when it comes?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the thing that was at the very heart of the Cambodian genocide and that is at the heart of many of the genocides that I'm aware of is a feeling of very, very extreme nationalism. So when people define themselves as they did in Cambodia, what happened in Cambodia was that the Khmer Rouge, the group that was led by Pol Pot, defined themselves as the true heirs of the Cambodian spirit, the spirit of the Khmer people. Some of your listeners may have been to Angkor Wat, this incredible sort of temple complex that was really the pinnacle of world civilization 1,000 years ago. And Pol Pot and Nun Chiel represented themselves as the true kind of custodians of the national spirit, and that anybody else who was coming from outside or who was wanting to do things in a different way was again was essentially unpatriotic and was anti-Khmer. That actually ultimately, because the ideology, I think you're right to say the ideology is not, and I don't think even in the Khmer Rouge case, it's there, but it's not really the thing that leads people to be killed. It's the ethnic and nationalistic kind of extreme feeling that leads to this kind of violence. And I think that's the case. Clearly, of course, that was the case at the Nazi Holocaust. That was the case in Rwanda, in the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. As I understand it, I think it's the case in Darfur, in Sudan at the moment. And I think that kind of extreme nationalism, which, of course, you know, we're very aware of in Europe and also can be a problem in the United States today as well, I think that is the thing that we need to be concerned about, because that, when you take it to its very logical extreme, ends up in genocide.
We're talking to Rob Lemkin about his documentary Enemies of the People, which is opening at the Screen this coming Friday night. There is, as you mentioned, a desire to confess that we see in the film, and there is a kind of sub-theme running through the film of Buddhist practice and Buddhist religion, and there's kind of this surrealistic moment where one of the killers is talking, and then he stops what he's saying because some Buddhist monks are walking by. And it's hard to reconcile, of course, the peaceful practice of Buddhism with what these men did, but what is the role of that spiritual practice? Like, how did you see the role of Buddhism informing the film Sambat, the people that he was talking to?
Well, I think that they all took a lot of solace in Buddhism. I think that, of course, the events that they were all involved with from the 30 years ago was a time when Buddhism was banned in the country. There was no kind of acknowledgement of any kind of spiritual dimension. Even Brother Number Two himself now accepts that that was a mistake and that Buddhism, you know, he can get a lot from Buddhism now. So I think they get a lot of a feeling of, the eternal soul, the idea of reincarnation. Of course, because they feel, because the actual killers who actually, you know, took people's lives and slit their throats and stuff feel so scarred by what they did, they do also feel that, you know, as he says in the film at one point, it's going to be a million years before my soul sees sunlight again as a human being. But, you know, I think there's on the one hand, that's a very depressing sort of thought. On the other hand, well, a million years and then his soul will see sunlight again. So there is a sort of a feeling of, a kind of contradictory feeling of, you know, it is a way of perhaps kind of coming to terms with the sort of absolute horror of the soul. And at the same time, it's also a way of seeing that, you know, time goes on forever and that maybe there will be a time that, you know, things can get better again. So I think Buddhism has quite a deep and constructive role to play and has played in these people dealing with, you know, what they've done.
Sometimes in the, for example, post-Nazi era, you see footage of these Nazis who did horrible things saying what we did was wrong, but then if you scratch the surface, they really didn't think so at all, because the hatred of the Jewish people was so deeply ingrained. Did you feel that there was a genuine spiritual, and not that you could know for sure, but that there was a genuine spiritual change on the part of these killers and people who ordered the killings?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the case of Brother Number Two, he's on trial now, and he will go appeal his trial. His public trial will start in the next few months in this year. I think he will go on the stand and defend himself because he believes that politically he was doing what was necessary to do. So he still believes that there's a defense for what he did. I think with the people who are receiving orders and then killing people, yeah, I mean, none of them have. I mean, none of the people, and there are dozens of people that we filmed. None of them, as far as I know, have ever been involved in any kind of violence since 1979, or even any kind of law breaking. They've been law abiding, peaceful citizens for the last 30 odd years. They're not people who naturally do this kind of thing. The situation took them into that. 3 years, 3.5 years of, you know, really what could only be described as madness, in which they were fairly regularly kind of killing large numbers of people. But they'd never done it before, and they've never done it since.
That madness, again, is something that is so familiar. In any genocide you pick, you will find what seem like ordinary people who then get involved in this madness, in Rwanda, for example, or anywhere. And that brings up again the question, when this stuff starts, is there anything to be done? Is there any way to break into that madness and restore sanity?
Well, I think that, I think in a way it's usually the case that large-scale kind of mass killings, whether they be genocidal or whether they just be mass political killings, are happening at very, very kind of critical moments of political crisis. And those political crises are usually being kind of the flames are usually being fanned by people from outside. That was certainly the case in the Balkan Wars. That was absolutely, without doubt, the case in the Khmer Rouge time. And I think that, you know, one needs to sort of always think that the world, international politics, plays a huge role, really, in any moments of political crisis, and that anything that allows one group to become so alienated that they feel they have nothing to lose other than to basically kind of scorch the earth in order to keep going, then that will lead to, you know, massive political violence. And anything that can stop that political conjuncture emerging should be done. And I think in terms of immediate terms, I think that's what could and should always be done by, you know, regional powers or whatever. I think on the larger scheme of things, in the more sort of eternal, sort of universal sort of scheme of things, I think that I do really think that sort of truth and reconciliation are the ways forward, because I think truth enables everybody to say what they did and what they remember of what happened and try to sort of reach an understanding about it together. Reconciliation then enables the society that has gone through that to find their common humanity. And when people can remember their common humanity, it's very hard to sort of drift back into the madness of sort of mass killing.
You mentioned a moment ago that it was quite dangerous for the people who were speaking in the film to be doing so. What are the implications of the release of this film for them?
It's dangerous for everybody. It's actually dangerous for Sambat as well. Sambat said the film has been playing around the world now for a year in film festivals, in cinemas like yours and so on. And, you know, in that time, Sambat has come under pressure several times. He's been chased off the road when driving his car in remote areas. The people who are in this film have just recently come under a certain amount of pressure from people who are not too interested, really, in the whole history of the Khmer Rouge coming out. And that's not necessarily because of what they individually are saying, but it's because actually the real story of the Khmer Rouge hasn't really come out until now. And this is the beginning of that story being told. But the people who are in power in Cambodia now are all from the Khmer Rouge time. Many of them, and many of the top people, the Prime Minister included, were in the Khmer Rouge at the time. They were in the other side of the Khmer Rouge. And there was a conflict, as I said, internally within the Khmer Rouge that led to all this violence. So there's been a lot of interest for the last generation or so in not having the story coming out. So anything that can be done to stop the story coming out any further may well be done. And for example, the government has not given permission for this film to be shown in Cambodia. They've refused to give it a license to be shown.
Is it going around underground?
There's one cinema in Phnom Penh which is kind of owned by the a German expatriate who lives there and who's funded by the German Foreign Ministry, and he shows the film. He's shown the film a few times, but we're not able to show it. And we may be able to put into place a kind of structure and infrastructure to be able to distribute it sort of underground later. But certainly at the moment, we're not able to do that. It's too dangerous. And I mean, and the people who are in the film, you know, there would be a danger that if people recognize them, there would be a danger that they could experience just kind of, you know, reprisals. And they would, you know, as they say in the film, they would completely understand it. If one of their relatives or one of their victims wanted to come and kill them, they would quite understand that that might be a natural reaction.
Do you think that Sambat found peace through making the film?
Yeah, I do. I think he found, I think, you know, when we finished the film, we had kind of thought that the whole process was over. I think what we didn't realize was, A, that we'd be doing a second film, and B, that actually the responses of audiences all over the world, but also among the Cambodian diaspora and among Cambodians, because although they've not seen it too much, it's been very, very heavily reported on the radio and in the newspapers and people have heard snippets of it. the reaction has been so sort of incredibly positive and more than positive, really. I mean, I think people really feel that Sambat has done an act of national reparation. You know, on his own, he's kind of done this huge project, which everybody feels they have a part of, and it's great. And I think what it does mean, though, for Sambat is, and with me, is that we have a huge kind of responsibility to make sure that all of the material that was gathered is properly and responsibly used, and as soon as we can possibly do it, that we make it all available to the public so that, you know, future generations, both in Cambodia and anywhere else, can really kind of learn as much as they want to from this material.
Rob Lemkin is an award-winning filmmaker. The new documentary, Enemies of the People, opens at the Screen on the Santa Fe University of Art and Design campus this coming Friday. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.